can happen to you if you're young at heart. For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind if you're young at heart. You can go to extremes with impossible schemes. You can laugh till your dreams fall apart at the seams. And life gets more exciting with each passing day. And love is either in your heart or on its way. Don't you know that it's worth every treasure on earth when you're young at heart? For it's hard, you will find, to be narrow of mind when you're young at heart. And if you should survive to 105, look at all you derive out of being alive. And here's the best part, you'll have a head start if you are among the very young.
FM, feminist radio produced by a small collective of old women and heard monthly at this time, 6 until 7, the second Wednesday of every month. My name is Rosemary Wally. With me in the studio, we have Lark Alouette and we have Fahmida Khan, who are both members of our collective. And we also have a guest for the show today, Dr. Josephine Dolan from the UK, who's a retired professor of cinema, but busy as a bee writing articles and a book on the portrait of ageing in popular British cinema, and also Hollywood, of course, that includes Hollywood. We're going to be looking particularly at how memory and forgetting are portrayed on the screen. Towards the end of the show, we have an interview I did with an artist who's part of an outdoor group art show in Stuart Park, Point Clare, and we have information on the art show itself, so stay tuned and don't go away. Josie Dolan, welcome to Older Women Live. We've interviewed you in the past talking about the dilemma of ageing on the silver screen, which is, of course, by definition, youth-oriented. But today we're going to be talking about what happens when the stars get wrinkles. Now, before it was wrinkles and flabby thighs, but today we're going to be looking at a different aspect of ageing in cinema, the decline of mental capacity. Now, you've written extensively about that film, The Iron Lady, which is a biopic about former British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, who had dementia and died of a stroke in 2013. Can you first tell us a little bit about the film, The Iron Lady, and what attracted you to it?
Okay, thanks for inviting me along today. It's a pleasure to be in the studio, so it's a wonderful opportunity to talk about this film. It's complicated to say what drew me to it, because I've always written about beauty and the Hollywood industry in the past. But here I am thinking about old age as it's lived, experience in the real world, and it sort of changes my thinking. One of the things that drew me in, of course, is Meryl Streep, who's the star of the film, who's the one of the exceptions to the rule around rejuvenation. Now, Meryl Streep claims not to have used any rejuvenation
therapy. When you're talking about rejuvenation, what do you mean, for those of us who are not in
Botox?
Okay,
all of that stuff.
Okay,
all of that stuff.
Facelifts
and things to make you look young, and it might actually be airbrushing that's done in the studio. It might not be something that a star has actually had done in the real world, but you know, it's very, very much part and parcel of Hollywood and British cinema, and that celebration of the older woman who still looks youthful. Meryl Streep's forsworn all of that. Also renowned as an actress, not as a glamour puss. You know, she's
she is.
Very much renowned as a thing, and has made some fabulous films, biopics. So we think about Out of Africa, certainly the Iron Lady, which I want to talk about today. And also recently that Florence Foster Jenkins that she really did about the opera singer. So really interesting films and very, very good. Now, the Iron Lady about Margaret Thatcher, one of the most significant women of the 20th century. Highly divisive politician. For listeners who aren't aware of her, she was the first Prime Minister of the UK and one of the first...
A first woman.
The first woman Prime Minister. Thank you for picking me up there. Oh. And also the first woman elected into office in the West. Really, really important figure. Now, the film was highly controversial at the time. She was still alive and suffering from dementia.
That's incredible.
So the film portrays the life, not the life, but the life and career of Margaret Thatcher through the point of view of a woman with dementia. Mm-hmm. So it's really incredible. And the ways in which the film does it is as much of interest to me as anything else. The film, as I was saying, tells the story of Margaret Thatcher. Does it through the convention of flashback, which I know most of your listeners will be familiar with. But alongside that, there are interludes where she's having conversations, lucid, animated, loving conversations with her husband, Dennis, who is actually dead. And this is how the film signifies and depicts her Alzheimer's and her cognitive loss. And it does it beautifully. And the relationship in the film, the relationship between Margaret Thatcher and the husband, Dennis, is very deeply moving. It's very effective. I mean, can I just say that I love this film?
Yeah, you know, film.
I want to forget some of the problems that I have with it, but I absolutely adore the film. I think it's beautifully made, beautifully crafted. I've never agreed with a single policy of Margaret Thatcher's, but I absolutely admire her as a woman and everything she achieved. So it's that they're the kinds of things that drew me in, wanting to tease out my own contradictions as much as anything else. So this is as much an investigation of me as it is the film.
I think it's important to just sort of state quickly how remarkable she was. She was a grocer's daughter, wasn't she? Born
Absolutely,
in 1925.
Yeah.
But a real high achiever, obviously a good girl. She just leapt through every single hoop. And she got to, was it Oxford in the
Oxford,
end?
She got a degree. She had two degrees. She had a degree as a chemical engineer and then later went on to get a degree in law. Before she went into politics.
Yeah. I must say, as a little aside, I met Margaret Thatcher. She was my politician when I lived in England. Yeah. I was a young teacher and I really wanted to do well for my school. And we only had one little sound system in those days. It was what we call a record player. Mm-hmm. And my school was a two-floor school. And so you had to carry this record player from one floor to the next. So I went to see my MP, Margaret Thatcher, to see whether we could have a second record player in our school. And she said, frankly, no.
Yeah.
That sounds like Margaret Thatcher.
She was so good at saying no, especially to women.
Exactly. Yeah. So why has Hollywood turned to making these films about older women? Because that's not the only film, is it?
No, there's a whole series. What's disturbing is it's a series of dementia films. You know, there are films about women with dementia. So think about this, another biopic, Judi Dench playing Iris Murdoch, the famous novelist, a woman with dementia. Think about The Lovely Away From Her with Julie Christie, a woman with dementia. That's fiction. More recently, there's been the Julianna Moore film where she plays a young woman with dementia. Now, I think there is one film. So there are about 9 or 10 films about people with dementia. There's one that's got a man as the central figure. So if Hollywood is to be believed, only women get dementia. Rose, I think you ought to say something there.
Well, yes, of course. And then, of course, there's the role of the men, isn't there, in these films. Can you talk a little bit about that, the role of the partners?
So we've got this situation where Hollywood is telling us that mainly women get dementia. Now, just think about for centuries, we've been told that women have got weaker brains. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it's one of the things that feminists have fought to prove that actually our brains are just as good and often better. But here we've got these films reminding us that actually women are more likely to get dementia because their brains are weaker. They also have the most amazing partners and husbands. So, you know, thinking about Jim Broadbent playing John Bailey in The Iris Murder. Oh, strange enough, Jim Broadbent again playing Dennis Thatcher in The Iron Lady. You know, he specialises in these. Same in Away From Her. You always have these absolutely loving husbands. You know, these these men who are looking after these older women with dementia, which I know many men do, but they were also young, and when they were young men, they were supporting their careers. Now, according to The Iron Lady, it was Dennis Thatcher who implemented Margaret Thatcher's career. He was there. He was backing her every inch of the way. Mm-hmm. He was behind her. He was making sure she had everything she needed. Which then, we think about it, that's a flashback to the past. It's a flashback to the 1950s. Same thing happens with Iris. Flashback to the 1950s. A good, caring man. So basically, these films are putting the new man of the 1980s, into the 1950s. What's wrong with that, you might ask? Well, if all those new men were around in the 1950s, did we really need feminism in the first place? What were we campaigning for? You know, so
and what were we complaining about?
And what were we complaining about? So what this retro, I think it's a bit of retrofitting of the new man that's a post-feminist move. It's actually saying, well, you didn't really need feminism because men were lovely and men supported these important, powerful women all along. So what were you complaining about? Why did you do all this campaigning? So, you know, that's one of the things that's come out of the research I've been doing here. Also, interesting as an aside, with some colleagues of mine in the UK, as Stella Tinknell and Susie Gordon, we did some work on biopics of women writers, which included Iris, but also Sylvia Plath, and The Hours, which is about Virginia Woolf. Lo and behold, these films have got the same lovely men in them. You know, so it's really troubling. And why is it troubling? Because very often these are biopics. Biopics are true stories, they're based on the real world. And, you know, they carry this weight of truth. This is how it really is. This is how it really happened. So it's not just like a fiction that's doing this retrofitting, but it's also the true story genre.
Yeah, yeah. But I think it's also important to say, I mean, we're sitting around here and all of us have had these men from the 50s and 60s. I think it's important to say that men were never expected to have any kind of domestic skills or to be in the kitchen or to know where the spoons were kept.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, this was just simply not a value that they had in the 50s. We were the little women in the kitchen and they went out and they had jobs and careers. So, yes, it's really very incongruous to have these guys in the film. Yeah. Yes. Lark.
My mother had to go away for a serious operation and convalescence for 3 weeks, and I had to drop out of a course I was taking to come home because my father couldn't even make a cup of tea.
Yes, it was probably quite typical in many ways.
I think it's interesting. I was having a conversation with Lark before we came on air, and she was telling me about sexism in the workplace in the 1950s. So far from men encouraging women into their careers, they were actually putting obstacles in the way. You know, so I think this is another one of the fudgings of these kinds of films and these biopics. So are we?
Yes, well, maybe on that note, we should hear our first musical break, which is Barbara Streisand, else, singing Memories.
Yeah.
She is smiling alone. let the memory live again. Every street lamp seems to beat a fatalistic.
So that was Barbra Streisand, of course, singing Memories from the musical Cats. Josie, how does the Iron Lady make claims to the truth?
It's done through lots of cinematic conventions that all the listeners will be familiar with. Things like archive footage inserted into the film.
Cleverly inserted into the film.
Cleverly inserted. Mm-hmm. So there'll be a flashback from Margaret Thatcher to the miners' strike, which is one of the most divisive events that ever ripped Britain apart. It was the moment when, obviously, the coal miners were on strike, not for more money, but to actually save the coal mining industry.
Yeah, 1985, yes.
1985. The picket lines were crossed by miners who were paid extra money to cross picket lines. They were defended by the police. It was made illegal to have picket lines. And there were some absolutely vile incidents, one particular one called the Battle of Orgreave, where mounted police with batons charged the picket line. There's footage of that all over YouTube. So that was part and parcel of it. Now, there's a footage of that used to establish the violence of the miners' strike. But so it's there, it's real. But then that's set along by artificial archive footage. So you might have a scene of Meryl Streep playing Margaret Thatcher inside a car with miners banging on the thing. Or other examples of civil unrest that divided the country at the time. So that's part and parcel of it. They're obvious ones. Things like the use of archive footage of news broadcasts or famous newscasters from the day. The film won awards for its costume. Consolata Boyle, who also did the costume for the Queen, is renowned for, and she did Florence Foster Jenkins, renowned for the detail of her work. Now, the publicity around the film stressed that Consolata Boyle, the costume designer, spent hours and weeks and months in museums like the V&A, where costumes are kept.
Yeah, Victoria and Albert,
Victoria and Albert in London. Going through the back catalogues of Vogue clothing to get the detail right. There's also endless scenes of Margaret Thatcher having her hair done. Now, listeners who remember Margaret Thatcher will remember that famous helmet hair.
Yes, yeah.
It was stiff as a board and worn like a Valkyrie's helmet in all sorts of ways. So that kind of detail is constantly telling us that this is a window on the past. And it's that claim to the window on the past that's so powerful with the biopic. Now, for many people, like, say, for instance, my daughters who are now in their 40s, that's the only knowledge they've got of Margaret Thatcher. They've seen that movie. They know that's the truth because all those qualifying factors are there. We're constantly being told, this is true, this is true, this is how it happened. So it's really powerful. What's interesting is that this overrides the images of the dementia. So a woman with dementia having flashbacks to her past, and we're still being told that these are true. it's really powerfully done.
And it sounds as though we're supposed to have a sort of very, I don't know, compassionate view of a very messy past, huh?
We're certainly to have a compassionate view of Margaret Thatcher. And let me just say, I'm not outside this. I've watched this film many times, and I've wept at some of the scenes of her dementia. Some of the, particularly the touching scenes with Dennis as he moves in and out of her life, and she's left forlorn as an older woman. The opening sequence of the film is Margaret Thatcher walking down the street, shuffling along, looking like any old lady from anywhere. You wouldn't know she was famous, and being pushed aside by younger people. That, you know, ageism is there in the opening scene, and it's heartbreaking. So, in spite of thinking about Margaret Thatcher and how I felt about her politics, the film humanises it in all sorts of ways. And the controversy about the film was not about whether it was telling the truth, but whether it should have been made in the first place, and whether that somebody with dementia should be pictured on screen while still alive, especially somebody of her calibre.
Yeah, so what's the answer to that? That does sound strange that they would make it while she was still alive.
Why not, would be my response, you know.
I suppose out of respect to a public figure that was a real giant of the 20th century, wasn't she, Margaret Thatcher, for England?
Because biopics, they make films about the Queen all the time, you know. True. And the other thing about this, it was this particular version. Since her retirement from office as Prime Minister, I think there's been something like 10... different films being made for television off the screen, from various points of view. However many biographies are written, but this one was a problem because it didn't start with her in a pomp. It started with her in her very human decline.
Yeah, decline.
And it's a refusal of her humanness, that she's she's really just like you and me. Her body will fail, just like yours and mine.
Of course.
You know, so I think that was part of the problem. And often it was her greatest supporters who were most offended by the film.
If I may just make a comment.
Yeah, Fahmida, yes.
Fahmida. Yeah. I saw the film also, and I was deeply touched, and I think it was beautifully done. Because you can also look at it as Margaret Thatcher, as her public persona.
Absolutely.
And her private persona.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is a plus for feminism. You know, we are coming across as strong, educated human beings, women who fought for the rights. She didn't have an easy time. And her policies were not just based on her, but her party. So it's the political party.
Yeah, but I think it's hard to consider Margaret Thatcher in any way working for women.
So then to look at her feminism, I think it's beautifully portrayed, and it's a plus for feminism, I think.
I think we've not got to confuse Margaret Thatcher, the real woman, with the film. I think we've got to be very careful there. Mm-hmm. And the film is very much about Margaret Thatcher's struggle, but she's very much a lone woman.
Yeah.
There's no recognition of any other woman, shape or form.
That's right.
In the film, you know, which I think we'll perhaps talk about a bit later when we've got a bit more time, because I think it's a really useful point of whether or not she did anything. But some of the policies that Margaret Thatcher did while she was in office were detrimental to working women. She, for instance, criticised working women. Now, she herself is a working mother, but she criticised working mothers as contributing to delinquency.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
You know.
Exactly. So that's a true politician.
But that's not in the film.
Good point for me.
Yeah, but that's not in the film, you know. So, you know, there are things. So the film certainly sets her up as this woman with no advantage, with no advantages whatsoever. Hmm. And it sets up the sexism of the 1950s brilliantly, except for Dennis. Where's the mention of Dennis's millions of pounds that bought her seat for her, you know?
True.
You know, I mean, she married a millionaire. I think I might have been prime minister had I married a millionaire, you know. But none of that's in the film. And one of the things always interests me about film is not so much what's in there, as what's not in there.
Yeah. Well, let's hear some more music, and this is our very own Canadian Sarah McLachlan singing "I Will Remember You." I just love this song.
I will remember you. Will you remember me? Don't let your not for memories. I'm so tired, but I can't sleep. Standing on the edge of something much too deep. It's funny how we feel so much, but can't say a word.
You want to vote in the municipal election on November 5th? Then your name must correctly appear on the list of electors. If your name does not appear on the notice of entry that you received at home by mail, or if you noticed any errors, you must report in person to one of the 30 boards of revisers taking place in the Greater Montreal region from October 7th to 17th. Good news for McGill students! A board of revisers is taking place on campus in La Citadelle Building, Suite 302, 410 Sherbrooke West. If you have any questions, you want to work on polling day, or you would like to know where the 30 boards of revisers are located, visit mycitymyvote.ca. On November 5th, take the time to vote.
This is CKUT at 90.3 FM, and you're listening to Older Women Live. And today we're talking to Dr. Josephine Dolan about the film The Iron Lady. Josie, can we just... did you consider this to be a feminist film?
I thought it was the complete opposite.
Okay.
Okay.
Tell us why.
Because Margaret, throughout this film, Meryl Streep, playing Margaret Thatcher, is depicted as struggling. Struggling to get through school, struggling to get you to university, struggling to get her first seat in the House of Parliament. absolutely, the sexism of the 1950s is writ large. However, she's always a solo woman in a man's world. It's not just in the scenes of the sexism, it's done cinematically. There are moments where the day that Margaret Thatcher in the film is elected to the Houses of Parliament for the first time, she's walking along corridors and there are shots of her dainty, beautiful heel shoes against hundreds and hundreds of male brogues. There's another shot where they're queuing to go into the house and sit, take their seats, shot from overhead, an overhead shot. Again, dozens and dozens of men's heads and her neat little hat in the middle of it all. So it's always this woman engulfed by men, which is all very well and done. But what's missing at the time that Margaret Thatcher was elected to the Houses of Parliament, there were other women MPs. She was not the only woman in the Houses of Parliament. There'd also been a long history. The first woman elected to the Houses of Parliament was in 1917, just after women got the vote. That was Constance Markievicz, who was a Sinn Féin politician. She never actually took her seat because she was an activist. So a year later, Nancy Astor is the first person. There's been a long history. And also, although it's always been up until Margaret Thatcher's election, there was often about 4-5% of women, of MPs were women. So all of that is right. There's not a flash of colour. There's not a single sign of another woman in this universe. There's no recognition of the women that were in Parliament at the time or were her precedents. There's no sign of the women who paved the way. Nor is there any sign of the campaigns that got women there. The very right to vote. The very right to sit, take a seat, the right to an education, the right to birth control. None of this, all of this is written out of the film in a very, very disturbing way. I call it organised forgetting. The forgetting of feminism is completely organised throughout this film. So it's all about her individual effort to get there, this lone woman on her own. And that's leaving aside any policies that she implemented. This is the working of the film. And as I've said several times, this film claims to be the truth.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, isn't it? You know, I mean, with a biopic, it's sort of half true and half fiction. I mean, Margaret Thatcher did not make too many attempts, did she, to show tremendous solidarity with women?
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, she cut child benefit. And again, child benefit has been a pivotal plank of the welfare system in the UK. Money paid to women to buy food for children. And it in real terms, decreased under her watch. She closed down nurseries, closed down childcare centres. She knows nothing to help childcare. She was so unpopular that the year she had her tumultuous, overwhelming election into Parliament, the actual number of women MPs dropped because the people who loathed Margaret Thatcher transferred that to other women candidates from other parties. So there was this real dropping off in the number of women in Parliament as a direct result of her. She had no women in her cabinet, very, very few. She loved having men around her. So she did absolutely nothing. She did nothing to pave the way for other women entering to politics. So, and all of that's missing from the film. She's just this amazingly heroic woman fighting her own ground in very individualist terms, and that individualism is Thatcherism encapsulated. What was that slogan of hers? There is no such thing as society. And the film really picks up on that, and so that's why I don't think it's feminism. So when that's combined with the lovely man who's telling us we didn't need feminism in the first place, and this heroic woman, and I use the word heroic deliberately, it's a male term, but I'm using it deliberately, that's how the film presents her. It's a really post-feminist film that's constantly telling us we never needed feminism.
We didn't need it in the first place, and we certainly don't need it now. And I can remember when the public, they used to say, you know, this is the real thing, they used to say that Margaret Thatcher was a man without a penis. That was what they used to say of her because of her policies. Yeah. There was nothing even remotely pro-feminist about her policies.
Yeah.
What about the way in which memory is depicted in this film?
Well, it's fascinating. As I said before, it's everything's told through flashbacks. So you get those shots of this woman who, a scene before, had been talking to her dead husband as if he's still alive, and then he disappears from view because the carer's entered the room or something. And then she'll look at an object, and suddenly we're back. We're in a reenactment of that moment. One of the most powerful ones is she looks at a bronze statue of a soldier raising a flag, and we're straight back into the Falklands War.
Yeah, which
again she implemented, and that horrible moment where she authorised the sinking of an Argentine boat, you know,
with what 400 people on board, or something.
400 people on board, you know, that's I mean, that is part of the film. I mean, the film doesn't shy away from that, doesn't shy away from the IRA bombings either, because that was the other thing. She was a victim of twice, because one of her closest colleagues, Erin Eve, was killed by an IRA bomb, and she was also caught up in attack herself when the Grand Hotel in Brighton. On the south coast of Britain was bombed. But there's no sense of any coming together, no will to negotiate. It's this iron will. She was called the Iron Lady, was the perfect name for her. So that kind of memory is there. And the film guarantees its own memory, because Dennis does not disappear from her memory until all the history has been told. There's an incredibly touching scene at the end of the film, heartbreaking. We've had all the history, and he finally disappears, and he walks down a corridor and disappears into a pool of light, and the screen goes white for several seconds, and you know she's finally lost him to her memory and is completely lost. And then the next scene is her surrounded by bin bags of clothes from wardrobes. And she's in there with the baggage. She's like the refuse, the rubbish as well, as an abject old woman. It's heartbreaking. You know, the film is really powerful at that level. And that disappearance of Dennis, there's a clip on YouTube that's millions of hits on it, where she's saying, don't go, don't go, don't go. And that's her, for the character, that's the last moment of memory.
That she has.
Yeah. And it's heartbreaking. I mean, I've watched this film about 20 times. I still cry every time I see that scene. You know, it's deeply touching. So, but we've already had all the history, the public history, the memory of Margaret Thatcher as the great leader by that point. So the film's very clever the way it does that.
So what's forgotten then in this film?
Feminism.
Feminism.
Feminism is forgotten. The whole history of feminism is forgotten. The history that got to there is forgotten. As I've just said, there's no way of thinking through the feminist struggle that made it possible for her to be there in the first place. She just did it off her own back.
Off her own back. Know. Wow. Yeah. Great heroine.
Yeah.
Huh?
Great heroine. So that is absolutely forgotten. That's the organising, forgetting of the film, of all the brave women, the powerful women who struggled and struggled and struggled to enable women to have the kind of position that she had, gone out of the film.
Well, let's just, yes, I mean, we are waiting for the next woman to be Prime Minister in the UK.
We have one. We've got Theresa May.
Oh, well, we have Theresa May, but I mean, yeah, there's another one. Yes, yeah, yes, we have Theresa May.
Yeah, shall we draw a veil over that?
We're just going to draw a veil over that. We're waiting for the next feminist, the first feminist Prime Minister of the UK. Yeah. That is what we should...
Another interesting thing is we can always say that's Hollywood. That's what they're there to make films like that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're there to make money.
And the bottom line is how much money, box office money, are they going to make?
That's right.
Yeah. And that's a really important point. And, of course, The Iron Lady is a British film. But without Hollywood, it wouldn't get seen.
Exactly.
Distribution networks. That's a really important point, because the bottom line, it's there to make money, not to make true history.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Josephine Dolan, for coming in and talking to us so lucidly about this film. Let's stop there and hear a little bit more music. And this is Billie Holiday.
Forget if you can, romantic music, one magical night, a call, a table in dim candlelight, a kiss that was heaven for two. Forget if you can, the day we hike to where nobody knows, the swell spaghetti at Tony and Joe's. It hasn't been fun without you. Don't you remember all the silly things we used to do? When we were photographed as handsome Hal and his tintype gal, why couldn't we plan more happy moments like we used to spend? They were so perfect, too perfect to end. Let your heart forget if you can.
We have a little PS, don't we, Josie? We were just saying during the musical break, there's another film that you'd like to recommend.
Well, I would recommend, if you're interested in the story of feminism, and interestingly, it's by the same director that did The Iron Lady, Phyllida Lloyd.
Okay.
And she made, but just over a year ago, a film called Suffragette. Very British film, I must say, British stars, and about the British suffragette movement. But what she does is she uses a working class suffragette.
Wow.
It tells that story from a working class point of view, not just the middle class women. And it's a film about domestic violence. Mm. It's a film about children being taken off their mothers. It's a film about the violence enacted on the suffragettes fighting for the thing. So it's almost as if Phyllida Lloyd had a moment of conscience after The Iron Lady, or maybe used the money she made from that to make this other film. And for anybody that's interested in that kind of film, I heartily recommend it. It's a brilliantly crafted film. Again, Phyllida Lloyd makes good films. There's no doubt about that. But this is a different kind of story. It's actually the story that's missing from The Iron Lady. So that's Phyllida Lloyd's PS as much as it's my PS.
Okay, so this is a film that we should be looking out for, and it's just called Suffragette.
Okay, so
that sounds absolutely an amazing film.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much again.
It's been my pleasure.
Yes. And the song that you just heard was Billie Holiday singing, and I've forgotten the title. It's all this talk of...
Forgetting.
Forgetting, yes. If You Forget. Okay, so the song was actually called If You Forget. Forget If You Can. Sorry, I got confused with her. Thank you. Forget If You Can. Okay, well, let's move on to something that we really shouldn't forget, that we should look at. And this is an art show. It's a collective art show, and it's on at the moment at the Stuart Park. It's an outdoor art show in a park, and it's in Point Claire. And one of the people who's exhibiting is Nicole Bauberger with her colleague Jessica Valenga. And they have got a project which involves doilies. Now, I'm not sure how many of you know what doilies are. They're decorative, crocheted pieces of, I don't know what you'd call them, really. Anyway, we used to put them on plates to make plates look pretty, and then you put a nice cake on top. Or you could put them on a sideboard and you could put objects on it. So this sounds actually quite an interesting show. And here is Nicole Bauberger, whom I interviewed recently, to tell us a little about it. Nicole, I'm sitting here watching you sewing a pair of moccasins. You're an artist and you have a very broad definition of what that means. It includes doilies, doesn't it? And we're sitting, I can see at the back of your chair, is a table runner that your great-grandmother made. This seemed to inspire you to do an art project, the Doily Webs. Can you tell me a bit about it?
I'd be delighted to. So the Doily Webs is a project that I do collaboratively with another artist named Jessica Valenga. She was living up in the Yukon when we first conceived of this project. She lives in Hamilton now. And Jessica also is very committed to community-engaged art projects. I had the privilege of doing a research project with Mrs. Annie Smith and her daughter Diane Smith. Both of them are elders of the Kwinlandun First Nation. And I wanted to learn more about traditional sewing as an art form. And thinking about their work and traditional sewing as an art form, beadwork and all of that, and reading the books about it, the books often refer to this form of making as art, but I feel like in our culture we have a long way to go towards actually treating the people who do this art form as artists. So it got me thinking also about what kind of art my great-grandmother did. And one of the things she did was she crocheted beautiful doilies, as well as edgings onto things like this table runner.
The doilies, for those who don't know, can you tell us?
Well, they're usually round, but sometimes oval, hand-crocheted pieces of lace, basically, which you would put underneath things, I think. I'm not super familiar with exactly what the use of doilies is, because I'm not much of a housekeeper. And in fact, I'm probably more comfortable with cobwebs than I am with dusting enough to make using doilies practical. And that was part of the tragedy, is I had these beautiful things shoved in my drawer and I didn't know what to do with them.
Yeah, doilies were also used, I think, on very special occasions to put underneath cakes, for instance.
Oh, yes. And now they have the paper kind that they use for that. I had these doilies and we had a Nuit Blanche taking place here in Whitehorse. And we wanted to think of something we could work on all night that we could have that kind of community engagement with. We together hit upon the idea of making spider webs, placing the doilies at the center. And so we crocheted rays out from the points of each doily and installed them between a lamppost and a bush or in various places, in a bush, in a tree, out in the world, responding to the natural world because you need it as points of a connection. And then crochet a spiral around to make the cross parts of the web. And in this way, we were physically connecting to this artwork of, in my case, my great-grandmother. But Jessica collected doilies wherever she could find them, in thrift shops, at yard sales, because they were undervalued, you know, 25 cents. And she would see them, and she knew, she's a textile artist, much more so than I am. And she knew how much work was in them, and so she collected them, but was still waiting for exactly what to do with them, you know. And so the other part of the exhibit, we built a wall tent frame. Here in the Yukon, people use canvas wall tents all the time, and there's a basic structure that's kind of two tripods joined with a roof ridge line and two other poles, basically. The trees are small here, so they basically turn into poles. And we built that structure and then webbed it as well. And you can see that at outside the Stuart Hall Cultural Center. We built that structure and then webbed that as well.
This is in Point Claire.
That's correct. Thank you. And the neat thing about that structure is when you go in, you're both inside and outside, and you have the feeling of all the care and attention that comes from these crocheted artworks. So you have that sheltered inside feeling. At the same time, you can look through them to the sky. And as you look through them to the sky, they're kind of like a rosette window, and it's a way of setting them at the center of something so that we can really see them.
Where have they been exhibited?
They've been here at White Horse Nuit Blanche. We did them at the Yukon Riverside Arts Festival in Dawson City. I installed a bunch of them in at the Tombstones Territorial Park when I was artist in residence up there. There's the bigger installation that's in Point Claire as part of their Geopoetics group exhibition that's up until, I think it's October.
Okay, it's actually October the 15th. So this is, it really does sound interesting. And Stuart Park is open from 7 a.m. until 11 p.m. every day. The exhibition finishes this Sunday, so you'd have to really rush over there. And you can get the bus along the lakeshore. I forget the number of the bus. But the actual address of the place is 176. It's Chemin du Lac. And the phone number, if you'd like to call for the information about the bus, it's 514-630-1254. And that was the artist, Nicole Bauberger. Lark, tell me, what's the number of the bus?
The bus leaves from Lionel Grew, and I think it's the 211, but the signs.
Yes, I think it's the 211 bus. So it's actually quite easy to get to. So that was the exhibition, and it's called Geopoetics, The Lay of the Land. And it talks about the immensity of the Canadian territory, both in terms of geography and cultural identity. The next thing that I want to talk about is at Espace La Fontaine, which is 3933 Avenue du Parc La Fontaine. And this is an event on Tuesday, the 17th of October. And it's something that I didn't know about. Apparently, there's a UN Day, an International World Day to overcome extreme poverty. So this is an event to overcome extreme poverty. It's from 3 until 5 in the afternoon at Espace La Fontaine, 3933 Avenue du Parc de La Fontaine. And it talks about that there's singing and there's poetry. And what they're doing is they're celebrating the tremendous resistance of people across the world who live in extreme poverty but are doing something about it. So it's not, it's something that's supposed to be very, very uplifting. Lark, you wanted to say something? You wanted to add
something
to us?
Well, we actually talked about it at the show last month.
Okay, well, that's then. It's to remind people to go again. 39, yes, to go again. This is the 17th of October from 3 until 5. One of the reasons why people are so extremely poor, of course, is the terrible, terrible spending on the military across the world. And so we're also having a peace demo this Saturday, the 14th of October at 2 o'clock at Place du Canada. There is a demonstration demanding peace. And this is by a group that used to be, some of our older listeners will remember them, Mouvement Québécois pour la Paix. So we are resurrecting Mouvement Québécois pour la Paix to try to cope with what is happening in the world. And they've got a few demands. They demand no to wars of aggression, no to wars that destroy societies and produce refugees, no wars of aggression breeding other crimes, yes to negotiations for resolving conflict, yes to the UN Charter being the foundation of international law, and yes, and they want Canada out of NATO. So if you are interested in these, yes to peace, no to militarization, it's 2 o'clock, the 14th of October, Saturday the 14th of October, Place du Canada, which is the Metro Peel. Now, one more announcement, and that concerns our dear radio station, this wonderful place, CKUT, and we have to raise funds for our radio station. The funding drive month is always in October, and it officially starts this month on the 19th of October, and it runs until the 29th. So it's 10 days to convince you to open your wallets and help us out. And we really do need help here. We were trying before to get some computers running just to upload something. And even the computers are really in quite a shabby state. CKUT totally depends upon this money. We raise money every October as much as we can. Now, if you want to get a head start on giving to our precious radio station and you can spare a little money, you can go to ckut.ca/donate, or you can call 514-907-9424. Now, CKUT has been on the air for 30 years, so this is our 30th anniversary and we're still going strong. So we really ask you to seriously consider helping us out with that. Unfortunately, our time is almost up. We're trickling away, and so we're leaving you with some music. And this is interesting. This is Pauline Oliveras, who died earlier this... Well, she died earlier this year in 2017. She was an American composer, highly interesting, highly original. And this is a song called A Love Song. Okay, so stay tuned to our next programme, which is Amandla on CKUT at 90.3 FM. And we'd also like to thank our wonderful tech, Mike Heimer, for his time, for coming here and helping us out. Thanks, Mike.